calm, steady, devoted voice that contained a love she suddenly knew how to receive. "Where have you been, baby? I missed you." "I'm sorry," she replied. "I have to slow down. I have to change. I have to stop." "Don't be sorry. I'm glad you're home." She nodded, wiping constantly at her numbed nose, and sat beside him. Simon had never been a physically emotive man, but now he put his arm around her and savored the press of her head against his shoulder. 10 days later, she learned that she was 7 weeks pregnant. In November 2007, she gave birth to Felix Rodriguez, a healthy 10-pound boy. 10 days after that, Raquel and Simon were married at City Hall. In the meantime, Rob had become involved with Inaira Cideros, her aunt. Ina was only a year older than Raquel, whose mother's and grandmother's pregnancies had overlapped by a month. She had penetrating eyes and olive skin. Her thick, dark dreadlocks fell below her waist. Rob had met her in 2003 when she'd come to New York to visit Raquel. He'd keyed in on her immediately, but not with any of his worn-out lines. Raquel had noticed the spark, and in the same way that Rob had subtly arranged her own first night with Simon, she returned the favor in kind by asking Rob to show Ina around New York. He'd taken her to a restaurant in Manhattan, then to a few parties in Newark. He employed the same gentle mannerisms with which he treated his platonic female friendships, and that's how they related to each other for the first 4 years of their relationship. Friends. What Rob was best at being. During that time, he'd been teaching at St. Benedict's while she worked as an office assistant at a plastic surgery practice in Miami, and they kept in touch over the phone. Now that he worked for Continental, and an airplane was akin to a taxi, he traveled down to see her all the time, beginning in the fall of 2007. He would call her on a Friday evening, just off his shift at the airport, and say, "I'm thinking of rolling by. You around to chill?" 3 or 4 hours later, after walking off a flight, he'd show up at her door, and once she let him in, head straight to her couch, sinking in deep with a protracted exhale. They spent a lot of time in silence, each enjoying the proximity of the other. His dreadlocks fell a quarter of the way down his back now, and they would compare the density of the hair, the consistency of the braids. Sometimes they would drive to South Beach for a party or simply to sit in the sand and watch the light from all the beachfront hotel towers play off the dark water. The visual reminded him of Rio, which he spoke of all the time. His friends down there, the attitudes, the career opportunities he would have if he were to make a permanent move. When Ina had met him, he'd been a teacher recently graduated from Yale. Now that his resume seemed less compatible, Ina had been prepared for him to become something of a basket case. A lost and angry soul burdened by his upbringing and quick to blame it for any and all problems he had. She knew plenty of tiresome guys like that in the barrios of Dade County, and she wasn't eager to import another one from Newark. But the man she came to know intimately didn't meet this expectation. He talked about those aspects of his life, the poverty, the single parent, the dangers and influences of the streets, but he did so casually, laughing often along the way. These elements of his youth were certainly a part of him, but as a birthmark rather than a scar. To her, he just seemed like a good guy who was trying to figure it all out and having a little trouble along the way. He seemed thoughtful, confident, and above all, hopeful. Ina had her own struggles with having grown up poor and surrounded by people who seemed intent on remaining that way, and when Rob spoke about where they were now and where they could be in the future, some of his optimism seemed to waft out of him along with the streams of marijuana smoke, and then drift gently downward onto her. "You're cool, girl," he said, lying beside her. "No thug love present in this moment." She inhaled his scent and replied in kind, thinking about a life with this man. He'd spoken about graduate school and various academic career paths. "Spoken around them, mostly. Teaching's easy for me," he said, "because I just know the shit." She visualized him giving a lecture in front of a college auditorium filled with rapt 20-year-old science nerds. Often the image would make her laugh gently, and Rob would say, "What the fuck?" And she would reply, "Nothing, nothing." The life he had in store seemed to her a good one, and she hoped to be a part of it. And yet, as they became more intimate, he gradually became more elusive. He'd say he was boarding a plane and then fail to show up. He wouldn't return her calls, sometimes for weeks. By the winter of 2008, he was spending more time in Miami than ever, but seeing less of her. The situation did not lead to the fierce confrontations to which Rob was accustomed, and which he at times seemed intent on baiting from her. Though Aunt Ina was 29 years old, she was mature. Her maturity was what had drawn him to her, the way her attitude transcended her age, and she could smoke weed and party but still seemed to float above the life-stalling whimsy that marked most days. She and Rob had talked hypothetically about being together, how easy that would be, but they'd made no promises, and she refused to become possessive. Her concern for him trumped any ownership she was inclined to feel, and she had enough experience to know that voicing concern to a man like Rob invited nothing but anger in return. Rob had his own friends in Miami now, some of them she knew, some she knew of, some she didn't want to know. They were hustlers of the particular variety bred in Miami, where marine passageways to Cuba and Mexico made the business as cold-blooded and fraught and opportunistic as anywhere else in the country. She'd grown up directly adjacent to this commerce. Simply by virtue of geography, she'd known men who had turned up savagely gutted in hotel rooms and Everglades swamps. She knew other men, some of them related to her by blood, serving long prison sentences. In a city like Miami, where that brand of easy money was always so tantalizingly close, the obstacles to living an honest life were hard to overcome. Ina had not been above dealing marijuana herself from time to time, in a courier capacity, which was basically what Rob became that winter, a courier of bulk marijuana using his flight privileges the way locals used cars. The transits usually began with a trip to Overton or Liberty City, where weed was plentiful and so, according to the laws of economics, cheap. He'd pick up two tightly wrapped cellophane cylinders of weed, no more than a pound each. These he would surround with a layer of lavender and other pungent herbs, also tightly wrapped, and then bind them in gift wrapping paper, complete with a bow that he would coil prettily with the swipe of a scissors blade. He would stuff these parcels into his high-top Timberland boots, the same style as those he'd worn at Mount Carmel and made illegal at St. Benedict's, and plug them with wads of dirty socks. At the airport, where he'd acquainted himself with many of the security workers through his frequent trips, he would make sure he was traveling during a friend's shift at the scanner station. Because he flew standby, he could time his flights freely. He would chat these people up on his way through and complain about how he had to cut his trip short because of some bullshit at Newark International, bitching about airline bureaucracy being everyone's favorite topic. And he would pass through and board his plane. In Newark, he'd drop off the packages with one of his old connects and pocket the difference, typically in the range of $500 for the 2 pounds and maybe 2 hours of actual work. The risks had never been higher, now that they included the FAA and DEA. He assumed these risks casually. "What the hell are you doing?" Ina asked, watching him wrap the drugs in green and gold wrapping paper dotted with pictures of streamers and pointed hats. "Gotta get my money right," was all he said. And he smiled at her, and the smile was dangerous, unconcerned, and affable, the kind of smile that had landed ex-boyfriends of hers in jail. "Explain to me how this is worth it." "Let's just not talk about worth it, okay?" She knew about Jackie, about Francis, even about his father. Indeed, she'd spent a night drinking with Rob in Newark the day after Skeet's funeral, and had been indelibly touched by his grace in the wake of tragedy. She didn't bother bringing them up, inviting him to justify his actions with the mathematics of his family. She already knew how skilled he was at performing this equation. Like most people in his orbit, she had never won a debate with him. She had her own baggage that she'd been dealing with for years, and that Rob had helped her deal with through dozens of hours of talk. What she knew, and what she couldn't believe Rob didn't know, was that problems such as theirs, problems that traced back generations and involved far more than money, though money was often their emblem, would never be solved with $500 every 2 weeks. But Rob, whom she loved, had a plan. He always had a plan for the day, a plan for the year, a plan for his life. He rendered these plans simply using ground-level details, and he tied his decisions to them tightly. When he talked through the path he planned to take from this moment to graduate school, with the flailing real estate market in between, his plans almost made sense. But the risks he took for the profit he made, from a big-picture standpoint, seemed only obliquely related to those plans. And Ina gradually understood that Rob didn't seem capable of seeing the big picture the way he had when they'd first met. He trafficked almost exclusively in the day-to-day, this shift at work, this flight, this city, this transaction, this chunk of money. No matter how skillfully he was able to string these moments together and stretch them into future years, he nevertheless struck her as inextricably lodged within the minute in which he was living, and never more so than when he asked for her help in a new venture, which involved guns. Darlene, Tavris's girlfriend, unwrapped Rob's gift for their son's second birthday in March 2008. Christopher was light-skinned and thick-haired and wiry like his dad. Rob, who had been named Christopher's godfather, gave him a full-size dirt bike. Tavris laughed. "It's a little big for the little man." "He'll grow into it. Do you know how many hours it took me to put that thing together?"
"Thank you," said Darlene, and she made a little show of propping the boy up on the bike seat, his feet dangling 6 inches above the pedals. They were in the backyard of 34 Smith Street. Rob had 3 seasoned pork loins roasting on the grill at low heat, his specialty, a dish he'd brought home from Rio. A tall, clear plastic tank of vodka punch perched on the fold-out table beside the grill, to which Rob had helped himself many times. About 2 dozen people were milling around the driveway beside the vegetable garden Curtis planted each year, wishing Christopher a happy born day. Neighbors popped in and out, young teenagers who had been not much older than Christopher when the Burger Boys had first begun congregating here to study and hang out. Then these kids had been little energy bundles running away from their mothers down the street, laughing gleefully while the women sprinted after them, shouting, "Get back here right now! You don't do this to your mama!" Now they were almost young men, wearing ribbed tank tops and scullies and tripped-out footwear, some of them dressed in red, the color of the double-eye sets. Two, there were the elderly ladies who'd watched Rob play street football behind their fans. They seemed not to have aged at all in the past 15 years. Music blared. Young Jeezy and 2 Chainz and Drake. "Fucking songs," one of the children called them, due to the explicit lyrics prompting laughter all around. "Fucking is not nice." Everyone was happy to have Rob there because he often missed events like these, the celebrations that marked the passage of time. Sometimes he would disappear for 2 or 3 weeks straight, telling no one where he was going, and the lives of his friends would adjust to his absence, reducing him to the occasional, "I wonder what he's doing right now," and the invariable response, which fell along the lines of, "Getting ahead on a beach somewhere while smoking a big fat blunt, no doubt." Then he would suddenly reappear, walking in the front door of Smith Street and heading straight for the Smirnoff on top of the refrigerator. He'd make himself a drink, sit, and launch back into the last conversation he'd had before he'd taken off, about music or the neighborhood or a girl. He'd been to Seoul, Amsterdam, Berlin, Madrid, Tokyo, Croatia, and places they couldn't remember. He was always at his most peaceful before leaving on one of these sojourns, always at his most restless and uneasy upon his return. He'd put off graduate school applications for another year and now was talking about the fall of 2009 as a start date. Real estate remained his go-to topic when talk turned to the future. But very few of his travels had anything to do with Peace Realty. No one understood why he was screwing things up with Dinah. She had visited more than once, parted here on Smith Street, and was the coolest girl Rob had ever met. A month after Christopher's birthday party, Rob woke up naked in a one-room corrugated aluminum lean-to high in one of Rio's favelas. His wallet and clothes were gone. He had no memory of the night before. It had begun with a woman, and his recollection ended with hopping on a bus with her. His head ached, but he thought clearly enough to check his abdomen for sutures to make sure his kidneys were where they should be. Black market organ transplants were big business in Brazil. He found clothes and made his way down the maze of narrow alleyways to the city proper, thankful that he hadn't been carrying his passport that night. It was April. He would turn 28 in 2 months. When he came home a few days later, having cut his trip short, he said to Jackie, "Ma, I'm going to get it right. I'm going to take care of you." To her, these words seemed like a plea more than a promise, and to himself more than to her. "I don't need you to," she replied. "I never have. Don't you go worrying about me. Take care of yourself. I just want you happy, foremost, and I want you around if it works that way. I want you settled." Jackie was fine. She supervised the kitchen now. She had her own office at the nursing home. She was off her feet. She had TV shows she liked to watch in the evenings. She had a pension and was set to retire in 3 or 4 years.
After that, she had her own plans, just like her son. She wanted to travel and see for herself a couple of the places Rob was always going on about. She was confused by all this talk of buying her a house. She'd lived at 181 Chapman Street for almost 50 years. She'd been poor for the same amount of time. That was the life she knew, and she was more or less content with it. She didn't understand how her strong, bright boy could bring himself such discouragement trying to change what she had. She didn't understand why he couldn't hear her on the rare instances she tried to explain it to him. Jackie hadn't been present at the Unknown Sons meeting when Rob had told a student that he couldn't worry about fixing other people. He could only worry about himself. If she had been, maybe she would have repeated those words to him now. "Go back to school," was all she could say, in her soft, understated manner. "That's what I want to see. That's where you've always done your best." Chapter 13. I can sell anything. Rob's face was low to the wooden table across from Hitaway. His eyes projected a rare intensity as he considered his visits to Pula, Croatia, some of the most relaxing weeks of his life. They'd spent most of the day on Hitaway's father's small skiff, just cruising along the rocky coast of the Istrian Peninsula. Tall, jagged stone cliff faces dropped into the aquamarine water and cast dramatic shadows beneath them. The temperature was in the mid-70s, and the clouds were wispy and dissipating. Hitaway steered while Rob, wearing shorts, a white t-shirt, and flip-flops, rode in the bow, leaning forward like a kid trying to get ahead of the craft, his loosely bound dreadlocks fanning across his upper back. Hitaway had grown up here, where the beauty of his coastal hometown belied the violence surging across the rest of the country as well as the collapse of its currency, the combination of which had impelled his relocation to Newark. He'd motored past these cliffs hundreds of times. Their majesty had not dulled, and there was something vital in watching Rob Peace watch the scenery, drinking it through his eyes like an elixir, the muscles of his arms and back gradually loosening, his expression serene. Tonight, at an old-fashioned bar near the city center, his expression was very different, ominous, and astray. Hitaway knew about the drugs, he always had, but Rob was talking about something else, something Hitaway had a feeling he didn't want to know about. He'd simply asked what Rob's next step was, assuming he wasn't going to work on the tarmac for the rest of his life. He'd expected more murmured, probably empty talk of graduate school. The place Rob went to, the sinister energy in his eyes, caught Hitaway off guard. Since their first interaction talking about prog rock, he had rarely felt uncomfortable around his friend. He said, "Rob, what are you doing?" "Just some movements going on to get me to the next thing."
"No," Hitaway replied.
"I don't want to know about it. I'm saying you don't have to do any of this stuff. Don't you get that?" Rob smiled and shook his head. He leaned back, drank from his beer stein, and reverted to his usual disarming self. "Anyway." Hitaway lived with his wife, Marina, in an apartment in Union, about 45 minutes west of East Orange. He was ambivalent about living in New Jersey and pined for his home country, but he had a good job with a Croat-based shipping company that sent him home often enough. Every now and then, as the years went by, he would trek to the hood to hang out with the Burger Boys on Smith Street. He knew that even driving the half-mile back to the I-280 after midnight was not smart, but he also knew from experience how to sustain the right kind of awareness. Seeing old friends and laughing about high school was worth the risk. More often, Rob would visit him in Union, always seeming glad to get out of his neighborhood for a night. He'd sit at their kitchen table with Marina and drink grappa and ask about their homeland before ultimately passing out on their couch. From these many nights had sprung the idea of tagging along on one of Hitaway's trips home. Unlike the ethnic buffet of Rio, Croatia didn't have a minority population to speak of. Rob could go entirely trips without encountering anyone of color. Partly because of that, he became something of a celebrity in Pula, a town of 60,000 complete with ancient stadium ruins in its center. The culture was embedded in every natural and architectural surface, and when residents saw a person like Rob Peace wandering around aimlessly, they didn't want to call the police. They wanted to talk to him, share their stories, hear his. To him, the place had no negativity, no fear or suspicion or territoriality, and hardly any crime. People were generally happy and curious and self-sufficient. Considering the recent history of the country, Rob was in awe of the energy that characterized Pula, the absence of hostility. The draw heightened when he met Lana Kasun. She was just shy of 6 feet tall, with a perfect angular face, tan skin, and sun-streaked blonde hair. She was Marina's cousin, a fashion model in Croatia. And also, soon enough, what could be loosely termed as Rob's girlfriend. Days with her were easy because of the slight language barrier and because she was an independent spirit, free from the manic, possessive qualities he saw in so many women back home. She treated the world and Rob in a sprightly way, day-to-day-centric and with minimal knowledge of where he came from for these visits. In heels, she towered over him, and at the taverns she would do little pirouettes and then fall into his lap with her long, languid arms laced around his neck. Nobody had ever been able to drink Rob under the table, but Lana could at least keep up. A week into his first visit, he told Hidavway that he would move here someday and began talking about some scheme he'd conceived of to sell ice makers here, since no one seemed to have them.
No, Rob, Ina said. Fuck no.
For over a year, he and Ina had been going to a local gun range in her neighborhood in Biscayne. They would wear the earmuffs and line up in adjacent slots to have accuracy contests. They would whoop and taunt one another throughout the shooting practice, the sharp scent of gunpowder filling their nostrils. In the fall of 2008, Rob convinced her to obtain a legal gun license. She didn't understand why. Guns and legality were not often linked in her neighborhood, and she had no desire to own one anyway. "Who knows when you might need it," he'd replied. "Gets heavy where you live, and you don't have an alarm. I worry." "Don't worry about me." Still, he made some kind of sense, and she'd gone ahead and gotten a license with no intention of actually buying a gun. Then, very casually a few weeks later, Rob made a proposition. He'd give her the money to buy a few handguns in the $300 range, and she would then file a claim saying the guns had been stolen. In the meantime, he would sell them on the black market in Newark for double the price. A strange alchemy of confusion and anger coalesced within her, seeing how he had manipulated her over the last few months, edging her toward qualifying for gun ownership in the form of fun and protection, interspersing this with increasingly grave stories about his grandmother's health expenses, and then putting her in the position of having to choose between his need for money and her own historically malleable morality. Over the past 2 years, she'd helped him network drug contacts around Miami. She hadn't been involved in any commerce beyond those introductions, and she hadn't thought twice about it. Marijuana was easy to compartmentalize as harmless, safer in many ways than cigarettes, an organic substance that offered a peaceful escape to a lot of people who depended on just that. Rob could be shady about that aspect of his life, and she'd come to feel that dealing was more of an addiction, or at least a habit, than the actual consumption of the drug. But he'd always protected her from what he did, and had never seemed in over his head. He'd never put himself in a position from which he couldn't also extricate himself. Guns were on the extreme opposite side of the spectrum. Guns were cold, hard objects whose sole purpose was lethality. Without the threat of death, a gun was useless. So she told him no, and additionally to get the fuck away from her. He did not respond with anger, as she half expected. He didn't attempt to reason her around to his perspective. He just nodded and said, "It's all good," and they resumed their day. For the next few Miami visits, she remained wary around him. She didn't want to ask whether he'd found someone else to buy guns for him, but she desperately wanted him to confirm that he hadn't, that her reaction had driven some increasingly needed good sense into him. She called a few of his friends in Newark and angled in loosely on the subject. No one had heard anything about gun dealing on his part, but that didn't necessarily mean anything. Rob was good at nothing if not keeping his life compartmentalized. She had known him for 6 years now and was familiar with all of his triumphs and setbacks and dreams. She was also familiar with the fact that very few people in the world had the options that he had. She'd certainly known people like her niece Raquel, who had come from difficult circumstances and gotten out of them spectacularly. In most cases, a definitively benign force had been present to enable the rise. Raquel's mother had driven her fiercely to do well in school, such that high academic prowess had been the only option. Others had come upon money by luck or had relatives acting as patrons. Rob had none of those things. All he had was a home, and a harried home at that, paired with his own drive. What he'd achieved almost exclusively on his own. And now, he was throwing it all away on his own, too. He was focusing that unstoppable drive on the very thing that could ultimately stop him. Her heart ached over the fact that Rob's life had come to this and that he, the smartest and most expansive person she knew, failed to see the wrongness therein. The sheer stupidity that she was watching bloom in these increments took root in Ina's head throughout that fall of 2008 and led to much self-reflection, and ultimately to an option she'd always considered but never taken seriously. That fall, Ina cut off her dreadlocks and enlisted in the Navy. With her education, enlisting felt like the single permanent exit from the cycle of crime and immobility to which her relationships seemed inextricably linked, a link that was clarified by Rob's desperate and dangerous behavior. The fact that her friend and sometime lover was trying to smuggle firearms made the decision an easy one. "There are three ways out of the world we grew up in," Raquel told her aunt in an attempt to lessen the drama surrounding her decision. "I went domestic. You're going military." "What's the third?" Ina asked. "The third is Rob's way," Raquel replied. When Rob saw Ina for the last time in early January 2009, she was wearing her uniform under her combed, shoulder-length hair. He whistled. "You look good all decked out." "Don't make fun of me. This is hard. You know how much I cried seeing my hair on the floor?" "I'm not making fun. I'm proud of you." She could see that he was sincere. "I just want to change my life." "You're doing what you got to. I understand completely." He gave her a strong hug before he left, first to make a pickup in Liberty City, then to get on a plane back to Newark. 3 months later, after boot camp was complete, Ina went to Afghanistan. Before she left, she said to Rob over the phone, "You know what? I pray for you. I pray that you'll be okay." She built up courage to voice these words. "No, I pray for you," he replied. "I'll be fine." At roughly the same time that Ina shipped overseas in the spring of 2009, Rob was promoted at Continental from luggage to the super tug crew driving the small but powerful vehicles, really just engines with two seats carved out, that towed the planes between gates and runways. Senior managers at the airline had approached him a few times about moving to a better-paying and upwardly mobile administrative position, where his resume could be applied to better use. He'd always declined. Admin meant a desk. A desk meant a chair. A chair meant the end of his travels. But the super tugs appealed. The work was more stressful, but it paid better, and big chunks of each shift were spent idling on the runway with his head buried in a book, waiting for clearance from dispatchers. Aside from Jackie, no one had asked Rob any serious questions about what exactly he was doing. If friends or family made an attempt, he would cut them off with opaque allusions to a larger plan, or even with a look that seemed to say, "I'm the one who went to Yale, so trust me, I know what I'm doing." But his cousin Nathan, even though he'd helped Rob procure his original job at Continental, confronted him after the promotion. "Sean," he said, "if you keep going on like this, you're going to be working for me the rest of your life, and there's something wrong with that." Rob just shrugged. During one work shift, he was paired with Julio Vega, the captain of the 30-person tug crew. Rob was famous now for the effort he invested in traveling. In 12 years, working at the airline, Julio figured he had traveled maybe a quarter of the amount that Rob had in his first 12 months. But other than that, he remained largely an unknown. He was fun to ride the super tug with because of his jokes, but his presence brought a weight into the cramped vehicles, an uncomfortable reserve that made you feel like you better watch what you say. That quality could make 8 hours feel like an awfully long time. Julio was reading a how-to book about financial planning. He glanced over at Rob's book, tucked discreetly on the far side of his lap. He saw a page filled with what looked like math problems, but with letters and rune-like symbols where numbers should have been alongside complicated geometric shapes. "What the hell are you reading?" Julio asked. "P-chem," Rob mumbled, turning the book away. "Physical chemistry." "Why?" "Just trying to stay up to speed, you know." "Peace, who the fuck are you?" Before the dispatcher told them to move again, Julio learned where Rob had gone to college and that he'd been a science teacher. Rob told him to keep that on the down low, but Julio couldn't help propagating the news. It was too damn strange, funny even. A low-key movement began to start calling him the professor, like his preschool teachers once had. The glare Rob gave in response cut the effort off at the head with the surety of a guillotine. Then they called him Peace again and let him read his books without hazing. "I don't get it. If I'd gone to Yale, I'd be fucking proud of it. I'd be telling everyone." Rob and Lisa Wingo were in the smoking section of the garage, both freezing. Lisa worked at the check-in gates. She was 5'1 and stout, and she spoke fast and constantly. When she wasn't talking, she was laughing. They'd become friends when Rob had said, "You don't shut the fuck up much, do you?" "I'm a single mother of a girl in middle school. If I shut the fuck up, she'll start talking, and I'll never get a word in again." When their shifts coincided, they'd have a drink afterward at a bar near the airport called Terminal 1. He came by her apartment in Elizabeth fairly often and helped her daughter, Dawn, with homework. The girl was as sassy as they came, but when Rob was around, she would just stare fawningly at him while he guided her through fifth-grade reading lists and simple division. Like his father, Rob insisted on proper, legible handwriting. After bedtime, Rob would stay and drink and watch TV and usually sleep on the couch. He called Lisa Oompa Loompa for her particular shape. She called him Predator for his dreadlocks, the same name he'd divined for Ty's girlfriend in college. He'd brought food, checked in often on the phone, and in many ways filled the gaping absence left by her daughter's father. Rumors began among the smokers that they were dating. "I could never date that man," Lisa replied. "We both like to needle each other too much, but someone should. He sure as hell is nice to have around." More than a few workers at the airport talked behind Rob's back, with a thick sense of schadenfreude, about the fact that a Yale grad had no business doing what he did, that he was taking a good job from someone who actually needed it, that his aloof demeanor was tied to the smugness of thinking he was better than everyone else, that he must be some kind of fuck-up to have ended up where he was. Lisa knew that Rob was not smug, and she wanted to believe that this place was not where he'd ended up, but rather where he was starting out. Tomorrow or the day after that, or sometime very soon, he'd be gone, doing something far beyond the limited minds in the employee smoking area of Newark International. She looked forward to telling the haters what exactly that something was. She wondered often why he involved himself in her life, why he seemed so motivated to take care of her. She knew he had other responsibilities, his mother, his house, his vast network of friends and family, his long nights, dealing drugs, his travel. But very few days passed without at least a text, even if that text originated in Croatia. Most men she'd known, both romantic and platonic, followed the same pattern of being around only until a more attractive situation than the single mother of a plucky adolescent living in an airport-adjacent neighborhood presented itself. Rob wasn't drawing any tangible benefit from her. She wasn't much of a cook, and he certainly wasn't getting laid. Aside from her sense of humor that aligned closely with his, the transaction, as it were, felt lopsided. But still the months passed, and his affection for her family, if anything, grew, as did the weight that seemed to press always downward on his broad shoulders. And Lisa realized that Rob did mine value from her, and that evenings spent at her messy apartment doing fifth-grade homework and watching sitcom reruns were an escape for him. An escape from what, exactly? He would never let her know. Oswaldo Gutierrez knew. He was almost finished with med school at Penn, and he'd seen Rob plenty over the last few years, as Rob would loop through Philadelphia after visits to the Raymond brothers in Brown Mills. For the most part, these visits were easy. Together for a night, they could smoke and chill and just talk, complaining some, commiserating, thinking out loud. But as 2009 began, Oswaldo noticed a circular aspect to Rob's speech and manners, a narrowing of vision in a man who, in college, had been more curious and knowledgeable than seemingly any of the 5,000 Yale undergraduates surrounding him. Like the planes that circled above the airport when the ground crew caused runway delays, he fell into a holding pattern of carping about his life while hunched over a joint on Oswaldo's sofa. Tenants, rent, Carl, women, work, money, even his mother. His laments were small and tiresome. "This motherfucker, that motherfucker, I'm so tired of all this stupid-ass shit, man." And yet they instilled a deep sadness in Oswaldo as he, in the analytical way of the psychiatrist he was studying to become, isolated the man he had first encountered at Yale and placed him alongside the one bemoaning the annoyances of his life here, now, 7 years later. Oswaldo had been there for Rob through all of the experiences that now separated those two versions of the same man. And unlike most of Rob's current friends, he was linked into the space that college inhabited in Rob's psyche. He could trace the many events and patterns that, though sometimes innocuous in the happening, had accumulated with a rigid scientific surety to produce this man whose generosity and intelligence were matched only by his flaws. "All I'm asking for is some numbers. Nothing on you, just people to call." Rob is asking Oswaldo for drug contacts in Philadelphia, perhaps classmates of his who smoked, so that he could hustle there.
Get the fuck out, Oswaldo replied. He opened the door.
Damn, Rob said.
So it's like this now?
Yeah, Oswaldo replied. It's like this. And Rob left, rolling his eyes like this scene was just part of a comedy in which he was the focal point of the farcical behavior of those around him. And Oswaldo understood now, with a clarity he'd never had before, that all of Rob's troubles were self-inflicted, that on Yale graduation day, Rob had stood within reach of everything he now didn't have. Maybe Yale hadn't guaranteed fame and wealth and general greatness, but it had ensured, at the very least, stability. Oswaldo had never been as smart as his friend, but he'd sorted his life out with the same odds against him. He was 6 months from earning an M.D. and had a probable job waiting for him near Boston counseling abused youths. He'd figured it out, and Rob was still clinging, after all these years, to the idea of being the man. Oswaldo was no longer interested in seeing what that looked like up close. Ty Canty's daughter, Akira, was tottering around on the hardwood floor of our dining room in West Hollywood, giggling as she repeatedly attempted to grab hold of our dog's ears. "Have you heard from Rob lately?" I asked. Ty, sitting beside his wife, Raina, leaned back and said with low-key regret, "I really have him, man. It's hard to keep track of him, you know, because he's always traveling and he's always changing his fucking phone number."
"Is he on Facebook?" Rebecca asked.
Ty laughed. "Rob would never join Facebook. That would be funny, though." "If you tracked down his number, would you text it to me?" I asked. "I haven't seen that guy since our wedding." "That was a fun wedding," Ty said. I had already roasted him with the story of my bachelor party, when we'd been standing on a street corner debating what to do next, and Ty had made the decision for everyone by saying, "I took the Fung Wa bus down here, motherfucker, and I'm going to see some titties."
"Not as fun as yours," Rebecca replied. Ty and Raina had had a Hare Krishna ceremony in her hometown of Kansas City, and we recalled the white man, bald except for a 2-inch long gray ponytail, singing endless verses of Hare Hare Krishna as a stall tactic, since Ty, when the wedding was supposed to begin, had still been back at his in-law's house in his underwear looking for a tie. Ty and his family were in Los Angeles for Raina's 5th-year reunion at USC, and we'd had them over for dinner at our small one-bedroom. We felt oddly grown up having a dinner party with my old roommate, late-night eater of soy burgers, wearer of FUBU, now on the verge of becoming a real doctor. He'd opted out of the PhD component of his degree so he could get out of school and start earning money. Raina, a beauty and a pistol whom he'd met at Harvard Medical School, was pregnant with their second daughter, though that apparently hadn't stopped her from hip-hop dancing for hours at the reunion the night before. I noticed my wife beside me staring at Raina's belly. Attention had already been paid to that particular element with congratulatory embraces, the females talking about morning sickness and maternity clothes, Ty looking shell-shocked as he tried to imagine a near future surrounded by 3 women, 2 of them under 20 months old. I knew very well the unavoidable gloom welling up in my wife, however. After 3 miscarriages and many tens of thousands of dollars of credit card debt run up for fertility treatments, she had a hard time being in close proximity to people who bore children effortlessly, by accident. The concept of getting knocked up was one that my wife would never know. Life was supposed to be easier. This current ran beneath all our laughter about college and weddings and pregnancy, and it rose to the surface when I mentioned that my second novel had failed to find a publisher, more than 2 years of work wasted, and that my third was losing steam. I mentioned this self-effacingly with a shrug and a smile that suggested old clichés of the journey, not the destination, being what mattered. The side gigs I took copy-editing self-published books that would never be read barely contributed to our income, let alone our future that we hoped would involve children. The current rose again when Ty tried to explain the economics of his and Raina's career trajectory. The $500,000 of student debt they now carried between them, the unlikelihood of being placed in residencies in the same city when they graduated, the ultimate aim to open a dermatology practice in Kansas City, so her family could help with child care, which would be difficult because the market there was saturated. We weren't speaking out of self-pity so much as presenting facts, and though none of us mentioned it outright, the facts spoke of something alarming about the world in which we lived and the generation we were a part of.
Among the four of us, we shared over 20 years of education at Ivy League schools, and we were all motivated and hardworking, and none of us were currently able to make life function beyond the short term. As Ty said at one point near the end of dinner, it's like, what the fuck? As they left with their daughter, we swore that we would figure out some way to have a reunion with Rob. He was missed that night. What would Rob have told us during the pity party? I asked. Rob would have told us to quit being a bunch of bitches, Ty replied. Before we went to bed later, Rebecca told me, make sure you follow up on that reunion with Rob. Sure, sure, I replied. Seriously, you should do that. It's not right that you haven't seen him in 3 years. I know. But like so many promises made to oneself, that too was quickly forgotten. Rob and Tavros, after many months of loose-ended talk, came up with a new vision for Peace Realty, which involved the Section 8 housing program in the city. Tavros knew all about this domain, having grown up in and around its living spaces. In his admittedly biased opinion, the program was nothing more than a scam, in which suburban landlords charged the city of Newark premium rents so that struggling families could live in severely neglected apartments. In the meantime, the Great Recession had begun to wreak havoc on the outlying neighborhoods. Just as Jackie had noticed the for sale signs sprouting weed-like around Newark during the white flight of the 60s and 70s, Tavares and Rob witnessed a new flourishing of abandoned foreclosed homes. The encroaching blight was personal to them. These were the blocks they called home. They watched as properties, 7 or 8 in a block in the poorest stretches, first went dark in the windows, then were stapled with red-inked city housing forms, then grew waist-high weeds in the yard now surrounded by a chain-link fence, then had the windows smashed by homeless people looking for shelter, or junkies looking for a place to shoot up, or looters scavenging pipes and appliances to sell for scrap. And then, in the final throes of this slow demise, had coffin-like boards replaced the windows. The process affected them deeply, particularly when they'd known the former occupants, which they often did, and more so when those occupants had children, which they often had. In their imaginings, the city would sell Peace Realty a few of these abandoned homes at a wholesale rate in the neighborhood of $20,000. They would themselves invest an additional $15,000 to $20,000 in renovations to bring them to a suitable standard, far above the Section 8 code requirements. Once fixed up, they would sell these holdings back to the city at around $50,000 to $75,000, still below market rate, and the properties would be incorporated into the Section 8 program as owned homes rather than rented apartments. The way they saw it, the city would be saving money overall by not having to pay premium rents. A few families would have a chance for stability, and Rob and Tavros would be making anywhere between $10,000 and $25,000 profit, a negligible amount for a typical real estate firm, but a life-changing income for the Burger Boys. If the first round turned out successfully, they would have leverage to expand the enterprise, and soon they would be making 6 figures a year. That was a career, and one they could feel good about. Tavros was trying to earn a proper living. He'd gotten enough money together to open up a small lunch spot in Montclair serving up egg sandwiches and burgers and grilled cheese. His older brother, an ex-con, worked the grill. Tavros was waking up at 5 each morning to open the place for the early commuters, and he stayed until 7 or 8 in the evening, at which point he came back to 34 Smith Street, where he and his family were now living on the second floor, to hang out with his son for a few minutes and then collapse into bed beside Darlene. He knew now what Jackie's life had been like during Rob's youth, spending all day on her feet and the rest of her time parenting. He also knew that it was no way to make a living. The profit margin was 2% on fare priced in the $5 range, and he'd been in the red for the first 6 months. Though he was just now breaking even, and the feeling of running a business that involved interacting with neighborhood people was positive, a cafe was never going to support his family. No one's ever going to give shit to a nigger like you, so said Flowey with regard to the real estate proposal Rob and Tavros were writing together. He wasn't being dismissive, he just wanted to remind his friends that the deck was stacked against them and stacked high. Flowey still dreamed of saving up a few $1,000s to move out of Newark. For now, he was most contented when he was just driving around the city in his preciously maintained 96 Ford Bronco. He took pride in knowing all the streets by heart, able to flow as ever. He wasn't alone in his thinking when it came to the business plan. The majority of the observers in their circle treated Rob and Tavros' talk of becoming Robin Hood-like figures in the real estate market with a smirk and maybe a comment such as Flowey's. They pointed to Rob's dreadlocks, Tavris's scimitar-shaped sideburns, their clothes, their language, their tattoos. The image of these two men sitting in a conference room with the city's urban planners incited laughter. And that meeting could happen only after they brought serious investors on board to loan them the seed capital. But what you don't understand, Tavris replied, is that this isn't even money to people like that. 100 grand for our first 5 properties? These people shit 100 grand. And then there's our ace card.
What's that?
Sean Peace. In East Orange, Rob was still tagged by his middle name. He went to Yale U. They have no choice but to listen to what he says. You don't think they're going to ask why he works at an airport? Rob was not present for this particular exchange. If he had been, the comment would have been phrased more gingerly, or more likely not voiced at all. You don't think that's a red flag?
It's all about the business plan, Tavris replied. They just have to read that, meet us, see that we're smart people. No one reads resumes anyway.
No one reads business plans. You're going to have to sell that shit yourselves.
Tavris and Rob had already put together a rough list of target investors, most of them St. Benedict's alumni who could be reached through Friar Leahy. And they labored over their written business proposal. They knew that with minimal entrepreneurial experience, a short-order burger joint and a single-owned property between the two of them, the document had to be close to perfect. They spent any spare daytime hours in the downtown Hall of Records researching the history of the Section 8 program, as well as the property values and target areas. At night, they worked at the kitchen table on Smith Street, writing and revising and haggling over the fine points.
I don't know if we should use exponential here, Rob said.
Why not? Exponential is good. That's a word they want to see.
It'll look naive. The growth we're aiming for isn't exponential, per se. It's a steady increase.
Rob drew an exponential curve, swooping upward toward infinity, and then beneath it, drew the actual projection in his mind, a clean line slanting upward with a 30% grade.
Did you just use the term per se?
Curtis, Drew, and Flowey were heartened to see this despite their doubts regarding the endeavor's viability. The two men hunched over a mat of splayed paper covered in red pen marks, kneading their temples, running on fumes, focused on a goal. They looked activated. The nightly scene reminded them of high school when all 5 of them gathered at the table or in the basement to do the same thing, looking just as worn out while doing it. Back then, they'd worked over Mrs. Gamble's casseroles and cans of grape soda. Now, it was takeout barbecue and vodka. Despite their skepticism, they dared to permit themselves to hope that this idea, after all the past ideas, might work. They would have loved nothing more than for at least 2 of the 5 of them to succeed at something. Rob sat back from his 3rd serving of pasta at Raquel's table. She'd just thrown an impromptu dinner party for him and Isabella Perezian, a classmate from Yale. Mess trays of cooling cookies and biscotti covered every available surface of the apartment, the baked goods cut and decorated to resemble the legs of burlesque dancers. After giving birth, Raquel had decided not to return to her job at Sony. She was trying to become a professional baker instead, selling artfully crafted desserts. Isabella's father had worked in foreign service. She was a smart, worldly girl of Armenian descent. While at Yale, she'd chosen to focus much of her academic and social life on black culture, particularly hip-hop music. Now she wrote music reviews for websites like allhiphop.com, and she spent nights dancing at clubs that were out of even Raquel's league. In college, during the few times they'd hung out, Isabella had seen Rob as a reserved and confident man, an authentic representation of the world that, for reasons she couldn't explain, fascinated her. And as they talked through the meal tonight, the admiration she'd tendered in college welled up once more. Whereas Oswaldo had come to see Rob as immobile, and in some ways pathetic, Isabella couldn't help seeing him as fundamentally real, airline job and all, harboring no aspirations to be anyone other than who he was and had always been. The baby cried, and Rob accompanied Raquel into the nursery to check on Felix. He stroked the tiny head while Raquel re-swaddled the blanket, and he said, "It's all good, little man, it's all good." Raquel watched the expression on his face and did not understand why he didn't have a child of his own, a person capable of focusing all the love and caretaking instincts that Rob had always dispersed thinly among his friends and family, many of whom she felt didn't necessarily deserve it. She giggled.
"What are you laughing at?" he asked.
"Just you."
Why me? I'm trying to help.
She lowered her voice to a low grumble. I'm Rob, the big man, the tough guy, but deep down I'm a big fat softy.
In fact, she'd laughed because she'd been picturing Rob with a little girl in his arms, crushingly in love, even as he complained about no sleep.
Uh-huh, he said.
Someday there will be some little Robs running around raising hell. You wait and see.
Later, Isabella and Rob were sitting in his car on 119th Street so that they could listen to a new hardcore rap group called Slaughterhouse without waking the baby. They talked about music. Back in college, Rob had schooled her on songs by M.O.P. and Jay-Z, but that had been years ago, and at this point, very few people could keep up with her when it came to the bass lines and turns of phrase in hip-hop. She wanted to impress him with how far she had come in their shared domain. Rob was mostly concerned with the downhill slide of this music in general, the selling out of artists who had once nourished him and now were angling hip-hop toward the shallow, popped-out style of Justin Timberlake.
It's becoming unrelatable, he said.
Yes, Isabella agreed. Most of it is whack now.
He sighed.
So, damn, what am I supposed to listen to?
She recommended Rock Marciano, an up-and-comer from Long Island, whom he hadn't heard of. Rob promised to check him out. Then he sat there, staring forward at the dark stretch before them. A block and a half away, headlights flashed past in both directions on the FDR, beyond which the city opened up over the East River, peaceful and at ease.
You need a ride? He asked.
You don't mind?
Nah, I got you.
He drove her to her boyfriend's apartment in Harlem, which was convenient because he had drop-offs to make in the same neighborhood. He'd begun using a portion of the marijuana he'd been bringing back from Miami for his own dealings to make a little money through a few long nights. When neither Isabella nor Ina panned out romantically for Rob, the letdowns occurred despite Raquel's hopes and efforts. When Renee Millian did pan out for him in the fall of 2010, the relationship blossomed despite Raquel's severe reservations. They met at Raquel's 30th birthday party at a Baroque-style performance space in Soho, complete with a red stiletto leather chair on which PG-13 rated lap dances were given. Renee lived in Clinton Hill, Brooklyn, and worked as a digital artist. She had tight coils of dark hair down past her shoulders and a soft, freckled, light-skinned face. Where Rob's sensibilities trended toward scientific analysis, treating life as an equation to be solved, Renee was visually minded. Whether in spite of or because of their contrasting perceptions, they were in sync that night as Rob laid down a rap. They remained so when they encountered each other at a dinner on 119th Street later that month, and again at Felix's 5th birthday party. Rob brought Tavares' son Christopher along with him, and Raquel noticed how good he was to the boy, coaching him about manners and playing with others. She also noticed Rob and Renee pairing off together away from the group, laughing in the corner.
I'm sorry, Raquel told Rob once he came to her apartment a few weeks later and formally unveiled the relationship.
You know you're like my brother, but Renee is my girl, and I'm just very protective of her.
Renee's roommate and best friend had recently died of AIDS. She had been beside him in the hospital as he'd drawn his last breaths. She was still hurting deeply, and Raquel didn't think she needed to be robbed in the wake of her loss.
I'll take care of the woman, Rob said. He was eating soup at Raquel's kitchen table. She's been through a lot.
He looked up from the bowl, locked eyes with her for a moment, and said,
So have I.
And Raquel saw it then in his face, the briefest reveal of what Rob had strived always to hide from her and so many others. What he'd been through and how it clung to him. She'd known of the weight he carried, but she'd never actually seen it until now, after a dozen years of knowing him. Before he left, she gave him her blessing. Renee lived in a narrow railroad apartment on the second floor of a brownstone. The walls were covered with photos, hundreds of them, colorfully doctored on her sophisticated desktop computer. Some were random street scenes, others were of her family, Jamaica, friends, growing up, designs she created in the vein of Salvador Dali. Rob loved being in that room with her, and she was struck by his willingness to come there, sometimes driving across Manhattan from Newark in the middle of the night, with the $12 tolls, just to lie beside her for a few hours before he headed down the BQE and over the Verrazano for a 7 a.m. shift at the airport. She offered to meet him in New Jersey more than once. She would have an easier time hopping on the PATH train than he would inching under and over the rivers. He always shook his head.
No, this way is better. except for the fucking parking tickets. What is it with Brooklyn and parking tickets?
There are signs, you know, that tell you where to not park.
He made a guttural ugh sound. More than the time he spent driving to reach her, she was surprised by his tenderness, particularly regarding the friend she had lost. Over the first weeks of their relationship, as she rested her head against Rob's chest, with his strong arm wrapped around her, crying sometimes, she spent hours talking about him. And Rob lay beside her, listening always, recording every detail and every so often offering the perfect word or gentle tightening of his embrace to soften her pain.
"Just move the plane," hissed the dispatcher's voice. "The luggage crew's not here. I don't know where the hell they are. Get it done."
From his seat in the small super tug, Rob was looking up at the massive 777, which more than 300 international passengers were waiting to board at another gate. The luggage from the previous flight had all been unloaded. The problem was that no one had disengaged the can, the giant conveyor belt that carried bags from the loading carts to the cargo hold 20 feet above, from the aircraft. And now the luggage crew seemed to have taken a break. Rob couldn't get a response to his repeated pleas over the radio. His partner that day stood to take care of it, but Rob stopped him and climbed out of the truck himself. "Not like I didn't do this shit for 2 years." Thanksgiving of 2010 was not far away, and a cold front had swept over the airport. With his head burrowed into the collar of his jacket, he climbed to the console halfway up the canned stairway and backed the entire machine a few feet away from the aircraft. Then he flicked the switch to close the plane's cargo bay doors. Maybe he realized his mistake right away, maybe he didn't. He'd forgotten to fold down the industrial-strength steel rails that jutted up on either side of the conveyor. Consequently, the outer edge of the plane's bay door descended against one of the upright rails on the can. If he'd backed the luggage machine away 2 more inches, there would have been enough room to spare. As it was, the hard materials collided, and the hydraulic motor that operated the cargo bay door groaned for a moment before Rob flicked the switch to cut the power. The door on the plane had kinked only a fraction of an inch. When he pulled the can back farther and once again closed the bay door, everything looked fine. The super tug was already hooked to the nose of the aircraft and facing away at such an angle that his partner hadn't witnessed anything. Rob folded the rails down on the can and returned to his passenger seat. "Good to go," he said. 20 minutes later, the plane idled at the proper gate, and the delayed, disgruntled passengers were boarding while the dispatcher laid into Rob about the holdup. The luggage crew hurriedly loaded the plane, disengaged the can, and closed the cargo bay door. Then the communication paused, and runway workers began gathering beneath the cargo bay door, squinting upward. The pilot had radioed the tower that a warning light was flashing in the cockpit because the luggage compartment had failed to seal properly. The maintenance team arrived with ladders and quickly identified the damage. The plane was put out of commission and towed to a hangar by another team. The passengers would have to wait 3 hours for the next available plane. The physical replacement of the door would cost roughly $20,000. The labor and service costs associated with interchanging planes and travelers' missing connections most likely ended up in the same vicinity. The question became, who was the last person to handle the door? Rob came forward. He told them that the door had looked fine when he'd left the last gate, perhaps figuring that the blame would be dispersed among the whole crew, or perhaps, like the child who'd once spilled milk in the kitchen on Chapman Street, he was simply relying on the old reflex of figuring out how this was not his own fault. The surveillance footage from the tarmac revealed whose fault it was before the day was over. Accidents like this happened from time to time, and a protocol existed. The very first step of that protocol was a urine sample. Rob refused to provide one. He also refused to file the first of 3 appeals granted him by the union's contract with the airline. After an afternoon spent getting reamed out by various supervisors, both on the tarmac and in the administrative offices above where his skills had once been sought, he was fired. No one there except Lisa Wingo heard from him again. The Facebook message from Rob came in August 2010. "Long time no hear from. Just checking in on you and the family. I hope all is well." I replied, "Hey, Rob, was talking to Ty and he said you're back home again. Hope we can catch up next time we're in NYC, probably Christmas. Wishing you all the best till then, Jeff." The previous fall, Rebecca had given birth to our daughter, Lucy, via Facebook, and in the midst of my disbelief that Rob had created an account, I'd sent him a few pictures. In reply, along with the words, "She's beautiful," he'd attached his own photo from Rio, backlit by the sunset, each arm around a curvy woman in a thong bikini, all of their respective features obscured by shadow except for the whiteness of Rob's grin. I knew that he'd worked at the airport, but not in what capacity.